Chapter 15. Evidence-based medicine. Doctors make a show of their knowledge and charge exorbitant fees. Their preparations, which are intrinsically worth a few pennies, cost shillings. Gandhi. It was around 2012 that I first heard the term evidence-based medicine. It was mentioned by a doctor with whom I was working, aiming to establish a small private hospital in Vladivostok, in Russia's Far East. This city was not somewhere I had expected to ever visit, and certainly not to set up a hospital, but then again, it is not too much of a surprise considering my travels over the decades. Born in Germany into a RAF family in 1960, I would be educated in boarding schools in Scotland, but also live in Cyprus and Canada before my father retired to run pubs around the home counties near London. Like my brothers, I would then volunteer for the army, ending up in Northern Ireland, Germany, Hong Kong, and the US, then back to the UK before retiring. When I hit Civi Street over a quarter of a century ago, I immediately moved to Azerbaijan and then spent nearly a decade in Kazakhstan running companies and operations across Central Asia. I followed this up with living in Seoul in South Korea, a few years in the Middle East, and then took my final overseas contract in Vladivostok. After this, I returned to the UK to settle down as my democracy and freedom of belief activities began to bear heavily on me. So, it was on my last overseas jaunt that I learned about the surprisingly late adoption by the medical profession of the idea of formally basing its practices upon evidence, something that apparently only really caught on in the 1980s and 90s. In the army, instructors at all levels had pretty much always used evidence-based examples, these being focused on lessons from history and unit or personal experience, so the late widespread adoption of such a practice in the medical field set me thinking. My first memorable experience with the arrogance of the medical profession, the most dangerous form of stupidity that I know of, came from watching a business program called Troubleshooter back in the 1990s. Its presenter, John Harvey Jones, who had been a highly successful chairman of Imperial Chemical Industries, ICI, which for much of its 82-year history was the UK's largest manufacturing conglomerate. The series was groundbreaking in its day, and Harvey Jones, who obviously knew business well enough, had also served 19 years in the Royal Navy. He had captained submarines in wartime and received an award for his part in secret naval intelligence operations in the Baltic in the Cold War, though the award claimed it was for fishery protection duties. I can remember the look on his face when he finished his program on our storied medical service and said that the leading lights in it seemed to think that they didn't have anything to learn from those who weren't likewise anointed. Obviously, no fans of Popper. What do you make of the performance of our public health czars over the past couple of years? Did they stand up to the dictatorially inclined WWEF Chatham House rule, corrupted youth leadership types in power? Did they show spine? I think having them study Popper and accepting that we know very little indeed is worth mulling over. We have two ears and one mouth, as they say, for good reason. Some old sayings retain their popularity because they don't lose any value over the years, whereas people's reputations can, do, and will. I have just heard that the Florida medical folk have revealed that males aged 18, 39 who had the jab and died within 28 days of the injection, the drug pushers in government-harried folk into getting, had an 85% increase in their death rates. You read that right, the death rate almost doubled for those who had hardly any risk from exposure to the virus. The government will do all it can to dispel suspicion about the jab, waving smoke pots here and holding up mirrors there, but the truth will out, like with tobacco. A lack of openness always looks suspicious, and every time this happens, it results in a loss of confidence in the system. Will you ever trust your medics, your governments, or your politicians as you did before? There are many millions of us that now suspect most authority figures, and this will not end well unless the people take over. Only with a major reform will confidence return, which is why I press on every day to my target of the hybrid solution, as these clowns will only look after voter interests when they are under our direct oversight. These dumb, dangerous, and dictatorially inclined people must not be allowed to do this again, let alone the even more remote and unaccountable Hui Chu. These experiences have left me increasingly suspicious of the ethics and mores of the medical profession and its allied pharma industries, as they did Gandhi. The list of cover-ups of cock-ups is phenomenal, and we have just been through the greatest one ever, causing the complete destruction of many lives, businesses, and national economies. The shutting down of alternative views by fiat, diktat, and officially endorsed nudges is, in my opinion, criminal. Liability may have been discounted by our craven politicians, but falsification and misrepresentation of tests, results, and statistics are fraud, based upon which very serious charges, including corporate manslaughter, could be initiated. I am looking forward to the promise Shakespeare made that, at the length, truth will out. I remember reading the autobiography of Jean Monnet, who set up the organization that would morph into the European Union. He never attended university, but was the son of a cognac merchant. And in his memoir, he told the story of how his family's business relied upon the bankers in London for credit when cash flow was poor, paying them back when times were good. He made the comment that the London City bankers back in pre-World War I times worked closely with their clients, pulling out all the stops to help and build relationships. Today, banking is better known as a money-shuffling scam, not a serious business, with entry mostly open to those willing to conform to the disreputable digital con it has become, lots of senior politicians, former EU apparatchiks, and folk like that. Its AI-controlled and flash-speed trades suck out the cream, leaving the dregs for the rubes. They have no downside to chew fingernails over, as the governments they have pocketed will save the too-big-to-jail party-funding money printers. Not only that, they are provided with top cover by the internationally connected central bankers, the real powers behind the thrones today. Our representatives borrow to their heart's content at taxpayers' expense for jabs, PPE, and spin-offs, whilst ignoring the nation's prepared, tried, and tested emergency procedures in favor of the actions pushed by the big pharma brands. One interesting point Monet made was that whenever he attended a meeting, for items on the agenda which he wished to influence, he always prepared a clear written proposal. He had found that most people don't go to much trouble to preempt an item, so his document generally became the automatic basis for discussion. In this fashion, he often got many of his proposals adopted, like the little idea of a European Union, leading him to being designated the first honorary citizen of Europe in 1976. There you go. Now you see why the military pushes the 7 P's so much. I wonder, did Farmer have a plan ready for their agenda item? However, when one looks closely at our gene, how good a European was he really? He was a great friend of the Dulles boys, globalist apparatchiks, and lawyers for the U.S. banking and corporate elite. Gene was a bosom buddy of John Foster Dulles, the U.S. Secretary of State in the 1950s, during the early muscle-flexing years of the CIA, led by his brother Alan. Gene met the future Secretary of State at the 1919 Paris Peace Conference and became closely involved in the banking and investment world, often finding positions courtesy of his well-connected American supporter. These leading lights in our institutions shared a disdain for democratic accountability, which those of us who opposed the EU saw written into it as plain as day. Not surprising, as Jean Monnet produced the blueprint. This common vision and dislike of nation-states was expressed by Dulles in 1941. We shall seek the political reorganization of continental Europe as a federated commonwealth. A federated commonwealth was a favorite of the Rhodes crew and their supporters of an American-dominated global government. Jelle Zijlstra, a one-time Dutch prime minister, said of Monet when he ran the European Coal and Steel Community, which would eventually morph into the EU. Monet had an enormous authority over national governments. He was a great communicator with a superlative mind, and he had the backing of the Dulles brothers and the American government, and in the 1950s that counted for everything. A united Europe was undoubtedly seen as a necessary bulwark to deter the Soviets and to end internal conflicts in the continent itself, as well as being a market for the Americans. That democratic stuff just got in the way, so manipulation was of course required, as it most certainly still is today. The Soviets have gone, but the aim and means remain. A State Department memo dated June 11, 1965, to Robert Marjolin, the French president of the European Economic Community, later to become the EU, recommends that he pursue monetary union without public discussion. The memo advises him to suppress debate until the adoption of such proposals would become virtually inescapable. Did the medics and health professionals prepare a decent counter to the paper-thin and politically motivated arguments of their manipulating, globalist-leaning governments? Cecil Rhodes liked using doctors as his colonial expansion-leading instruments because he knew they were less squeamish about death and dying, particularly of local opposition facing his Maxim machine guns. Surgeons are famously arrogant, little gods like Soros. There are no angels out there, no utopias to run to. What there is to learn is almost limitless, and this should give us all pause to think on our ignorance. However, humility seems to be increasingly rare, and moral courage is in even shorter supply than the physical version. Bear this in mind the next time someone tells you to do something that your instincts make you wary of, and ask them, why? Then, ask again, and keep at this until you get a good reason. And if not, then ignore them and go about your business. The recent history of the greed machine that is pharma is not a pleasant one. Look into the Sackler family and the opioid crisis in the US. These wonderful human beings pushed the drugs through networks of doctors, targeting their sales efforts at the medics most willing to prescribe the drugs, then pressing them to increase the strength of the dose, and with it, their profits. Once they had pushed this program, they developed drugs to help reduce their effects. It's all available with a Google or YouTube search. You should also find that hundreds of thousands of generally poor Americans died from addiction to opioids. But in 2021, the family settled the account by forking out $4.5 billion, but with immunity from prosecution as the price of their generosity. Does that sound familiar? No crime, no time, unlike those who can't afford the cream of the legal crop. While at it, check out how the world's leading consultancy company, supposedly respectable too, McKinsey, paid out over $600 million to wipe the slate clean, as you do in these rinse-and-repeat scams. They advised the Sacklers on their sales strategy, even overriding the family's Purdue company executives. Studies of college students have noted that those on MBA courses are the most likely to lie, so don't be fooled by the suit. Whenever you see one, turn all your antennae on and start thinking about the three B's. The infamous, in some circles, Tavistock Clinic was shut down with extreme prejudice by the NHS after an investigation into its trans policies, with shameful practices exposed and the lives of thousands of children and their families devastated. The medics and mindbenders justified sex changes for kids too young to drink, vote, and die for their country, but how could that go wrong? Doctors were in charge. Well, the trigger for the rapid shutdown appears to have been the publication of Time to Think by Hannah Barnes, in which she notes that back in the 1980s, only a few dozen kids a year in Britain received counselling for gender dysphoria. Of those, 80% of the cases resolved themselves by the time the children became adults, and only 5% of those initially receiving treatment went on to become trans adults. In fact, most of those referred for treatment were homosexual or lesbian. However, when the special unit moved to Tavistock, the real madness began, with the handful of cases turning into thousands, and with operations taking place in ever younger children. The doctors basically lacked the courage to face down the activists, yet our 19-year-old assault infantrymen, fresh off council estates and sent on their way when our country demands it, have the courage to face mines, RPGs, and AKs. But who has status? The white-coated doc? Or the grubby uniformed squaddy? As an atheist, I have grown to be wary of my fellow non-believers because when push comes to shove, many seem to lack the courage of their convictions. This is certainly not true for all, but it seems to be quite widespread. Hence our failure to give the politicians a good kick in the particulars when they overextended themselves during the recent Big Pharma benefit event. Some critical thinking during the crisis could easily have limited the overreach by our leaders. But where was the pushback from the medics with their evidence-based thinking? I attended the march in support of the 100,000 NHS medics who were to be thrown out for refusing the jab, a complete fascistic disgrace and the high watermark of the government's hubris. The Japanese handled this much better than us, advising and not directing, and this worked out much better, didn't it, Mr. Hancock? I recently attended a free speech event in which several of the mothers present made the point that their children were now extremely wary of speaking about pretty much anything. This is due to an almost complete failure on our part to take on the activists out there. The woman hosting the event made a very good point that it is up to us, the Grey Brigade, to take on the disturbed enforcers. Those of us more used to speaking out, who are comfortable in a debate, must, if necessary, confront people peacefully but forcefully. So, no more sloping shoulders, others have made the breach, and it is for all of us to pour through and take back speech for the kids. There's no need for charging up hills, so age is only an excuse. Get your comfy shoes on and save this great nation and your grandchildren's futures. A reckoning is coming, and I look forward to it. But we need to stand shoulder to shoulder and back those leading the way. Conformance is often just a form of cowardice, which is why the non-conforming are often let go, being too honest to play along and to accept groupthink. After an event like the COVID mess, a public inquiry led by status quo supporters usually finds nout, and if you are lucky, maybe a few lessons are learned. However, the pensions of the useless apparatchiks remain paid, and the system stumbles onto the next foreseeable scandal, after which further lessons will be learned, etc., etc. Try that in a direct democracy-controlled system. The oversight is tougher, and the people's beady eyes fixed on the target are clearer. Just another benefit worth thinking on, no? I can tell you now that what is coming down the pipe will already have been played out in scenarios in palatial conference rooms, maybe recently, but in all likelihood some years ago. College grads and experienced managers knock out scenarios based upon guidance from and discussions with the leading lights. The details are thrashed out and presented for approval by those paying for the get-togethers in the resorts where the playbooks are gamed. Rough ideas get polished and new ones thought through. These events are presented as planning sessions in case of, but they are preparations for controlled social explosions to disconcert the masses and allow the imposition of the utopian vision of those looking to profit and save the planet. You can guess who these might be. And if you stick out like a tall poppy, they'll cut you down. In 1962, during the Cold War, the French intellectual Jacques Ellul wrote about the dangers of adopting the totalitarian's techniques in propaganda, the formation of men's attitudes. He warned that propaganda will swallow democracies tempted to use it as it is directed at man, to make him conform, which is the aim of all propaganda, with nudge units, wittingly or not, ensuring that forces thus unleashed are rarely brought under control again. So, our mini-me copies of CCP enforcers were turned against other Britons, the independent non-believers that this nation once gloried in. The hyped-up threat, like all myths, took on a force such that it became impossible, in the eyes of believers, of being questioned. But this tends to eliminate all opposing truth, which is immediately called error. Once democracy becomes the object of propaganda, it also becomes as totalitarian, authoritarian, and exclusive as dictatorship. Matt Hancock and his cohorts created fear and division, with the fearful turning on those who were not. But the government's propaganda barrage led to massive family and community differences that still exist in some form years after the event, and our representatives are to blame because democracy is a way of life composed of tolerance, respect, degree, choice, diversity, and so on. All propaganda that acts on behavior and feelings and transforms them in depth turns man into someone who can no longer support democracy because he no longer follows democratic behavior. Elul, 1973, p. 250. That's not what we are supposed to be about, and our piddling MPs should be seeking to bring us together, not driving us apart. Remember what they did. It is interesting to see our jailers looking at us with so much contempt. This is the people that kicked off the Industrial Revolution, that saw to the eradication of slavery across great swathes of the planet, and championed the development of a form of democracy that had its strengths once. Even foreign enemies recognized our qualities as a people, including Leon Trotsky, who referred to the unquestionable greatness of the Anglo-Saxon genius. Humility and openness to criticism are not weaknesses, they are the basis of wisdom and courage, which are inextricably linked. The medical profession, the drug suppliers, and the oversight apparatus failed all of us and destroyed faith in all their fields, and science too. This disaster can only be overcome with the involvement of the people, and that can only come from our being responsible for the policies and laws which are imposed upon us. Consent be damned. They don't seek it or care for it. Now we need to be in control. The current machinery has proven itself to have intrinsic failings, which can only be addressed by the addition of more knowledgeable mechanics, and they can only be found among the broad spectrum of talents which the population as a whole can provide, not from a smattering of fruitcakes in a select and corruptible crew of self-regarding wazocks.